Okay, welcome back. Let's get right to it. I've got a couple things I want to do here before we get to Dr. Henry Nyman. First, Henry, welcome back. I just want to do a couple quick things here, then we're going to jump right into it. How are you?
Okay, sounds good.
All right. This has to do with Trump and Kushner. And I have a lot of headlines in headlines about Jerry Kushner. Here's a big one. I'm going to read just a little bit from the story. Jerry Kushner is the de facto president of the United States, says former White House official. By now, Jared Kushner's White House resume is quite extensive. His father-in-law, Donald Trump, tasked him with brokering peace between Israel and Palestine, completing an environmentally destructive wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, reforming the criminal justice system of this country, and building an Office of American Innovation dedicated to making the government run like a business. Well, despite Jerry's failing to follow through on any of these tasks, Trump also put him in charge of the U.S. coronavirus response, complete with his own shadow task force, made up of equally unqualified friends, which caused confusion about competing power structures. Speaking to Time magazine for a January profile of Kushner, Brad Parscale, the Kushner-appointed manager of Trump's campaign, said, quote, "Nobody has more influence in the White House than Jared. Nobody has more influence outside the White House than Jared. He's number two after Trump." Some would argue he's not number two. He's number one. I've got a bunch of headline stories up there right now for all of you to take a look at. Most comforting of all, though, Henry, Jerry tells us that much of the country is going to be completely back to normal in June. Well, this
so
farmer...
What year?
Yeah, we didn't say that. Sorry, you didn't say that. This farmer in Texas, you'll hear for the next 60 seconds, might have a little different opinion than President Kushner. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are plowing under vegetable crops from coast to coast. We are euthanizing millions of chickens. We are aborting sows and burying feeder pigs. We are dumping milk by the hundreds of thousands of gallons, and now they are preparing us to depopulate the fat cattle ready to harvest because of a bottleneck created by the effects of COVID. This thing hasn't been created by COVID, but the effects of COVID and the logistics therein. We are in trouble. Our food supply is in trouble, and I am appealing to producers and consumers across the nation to start calling. Yesterday, the first shipment of imported beef from the country of Namibia hit the shores of the United States of America.
Okay, you get the idea. All right, they're bringing in beef now from halfway around the world, southeastern Africa, the country of Namibia. So you got to understand that this... This problem is we're in for trouble. It's going to be real bad real soon. And I hope all of you out there, if you can still go shopping, buy as much as you can. Buy cases. Ask for special deliveries to the store for you of cases of baked beans, whatever. You can live on a can of baked beans a day. This could get dicey for a lot of Americans real quick. All right, it's time for our nightly coronavirus report with Dr. Henry Nyman, Ph.D., We've been at this. Our first program was January the 8th. If you've been with us, you know more than 99% of the American people. Henry, go ahead. What's up?
Okay. Well, there's some evidence to support some of the issues you brought up initially. And the food supply is definitely near the top of the list. And that is in part because of various processing plants for both, or for all three, for beef, pork, and poultry. And they're mostly linked to outbreaks of COVID at these various plants. And that's just situations getting increasingly worse. So I'll go into that in a little bit. I wanted to first talk about just what the virus is doing. And, you know, I've been tracking each of the reports that comes out every day from the state labs to get an idea how many new cases there are and how many new deaths there are on a daily basis. And those numbers are kind of raising some questions about exactly how quickly the death toll is going to go up and how likely it is that the virus is going to kind of fade over the summer. And that data is looking like the virus isn't going to fade. And or if it does, it's not going to fade
not
dramatically.
Much.
And and the death toll is going to continue increasing at a fairly steady rate at a high level. And those rates, that rate is really destroying all of these projections. And I wanted to kind of run through that just as a reminder.
But gosh, President Kushner just told us that everything's going to be fine in 4 weeks in June.
No, he said June.
4 weeks.
He said June.
From now. Yeah, June. Four weeks from now is June. Oh, May. Yeah May. No,
so,
we got 4 weeks to go through in May, then we got June. So it's 4 weeks, a month, whatever.
Right. But June's also, you know, 56 weeks away, too. So anyway.
Oh, that June.
Yeah. He didn't say which June. He just said June. So here's the reason his June story of this year is pretty much already dead in the water. And the issue, you know, that I'm going to focus on is more the deaths, because the deaths were really driving, the predicted deaths were really driving the social distancing and the flattening of the curve. And and just as a reminder, the flattening of the curve doesn't really lead to fewer cases. It leads to fewer deaths, and the reasoning is that if you don't flatten the curve, you'll get a sharp peak, and the sharp peak will overrun the medical delivery systems, and hospitals will be full, and therefore people will die because either A, they don't get the right treatment when they get to the hospital, or B, they don't get picked up to go to the hospital because the EMTs are overrun, or they end up just dying at home because there's no room in the hospitals. And so the death rate is unnecessarily elevated because of care delivery. And then more of the healthcare workers end up getting infected because there's too many cases coming in, and it's hard to keep up with the PPEs, and it just creates a relatively short-lived but very intense type of problems, which leads to an increase in the deaths. So the idea is with the social distancing, the curve gets flattened, and therefore there are cases that come to the hospital over a longer time period, but the number of cases on a given day is reduced, and then the healthcare systems can handle that. And that led to some dramatic differences in projections. And the initial projections were that if you did do social distancing and you did it fairly well, there would be between 100 and 200,000 deaths in the United States. And if you didn't do the social distancing, then you would run into a situation where healthcare would be totally overrun. And you'd have between like 1.5 or 1.1 to 2.4 or something million people dying in the United States. And Trump used those numbers to basically say that he really didn't have any choice, that, you know, 1 to 2 million deaths was way too many, and even 1 to 200,000 was too many, but it was, you know, significantly better, and therefore you couldn't just let it rip. You had to go ahead and try to slow the virus down, and that led to the social distancing. And then a few weeks ago, and I don't like these projections. I mean, the problems with the projections is it's just too easy to get a wide variance in the numbers based upon a few of the assumptions. And on top of that, a lot of the data that's going in is faulty because, especially if there's testing issues and you don't really have enough kits, so you're underestimating the cases, and so you're taking false numbers going in and putting it in the model and then making a bunch of assumptions on how long it's going to continue at an exponential rate. And you know, if you change that by a few days, you can end up, or a week or two, you can end up with differences that are kind of tenfold higher. So, I mean, you can get a difference between 100,000 and 1 million deaths by simply saying that, well, it goes 2 weeks longer to get the 1 million versus 100,000, because it only takes 2 to 3 days for the number to double. So you don't need that many doublings to get it 10 times higher. And that's just a few weeks, actually. So anyway, there's a lot of issues with making the predictions, but a lot of predictions are made and kind of got to go with something. So you kind of pull these out. And the one prediction they kind of settled on was the one I said, which is 1 to 200,000 with social distancing as far as deaths are concerned. And then that prediction got revised 2 or 3 weeks ago. And maybe it's even a month ago now, but it was revised downward, kind of as an indication that the social distancing worked better than anticipated. And the new number was 60,000 deaths. So it was kind of, we're going to have 60,000 deaths through the August. Probably sometime in August. So you're going to get through the summer, you're going to get through the rest of the spring, and you're going to end up with 60,000 deaths.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Trump jumped all over that and said, oh, you know, we should be able to do that. If we get it down to 60,000, that's going to be a major victory. You know, if we get it under 60,000, that would be even bigger. And so that was his new target. It was, you know, 60,000 deaths in the United States was not only an acceptable number, that was an indication that, you know, everything was going well and that, you know, Trump did a great job. And it quickly became clear that that revision seemed to be, you know, overly optimistic, because the curve kind of flattened out, but it flattened out in the neighborhood of 25 to 35,000 cases, new cases every day, and in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 2,500 deaths every day. And, you know, it's not hard to do the math that if you got 2,000 deaths a day, you know, you're going to get 10,000 deaths in 5 days. You know, less than a week, you're going to get an extra 10,000.
So but which week was that, Henry? Which year?
Right. That's what made Trump's prediction a little over a week ago, that he thought that, you know, we're going to end up with 50,000 deaths or so, and it's going to break that 60,000 mark. And when he made that, there was already 40-something thousand deaths and 50,000 was going to happen within a week of his pronouncement. Right. It's going to be like within 5 days. Right. And that's exactly what happened. So by the end of last week, it was already up to 50,000. And so it was clear that it wasn't August yet, but it was 50,000. And the prediction that it was going to be 60,000 was probably optimistic. So then Trump kind of switched from saying, well, it's going to be 50 to 60,000 to, well, it's going to be 60 to 70,000. And that still seemed to be kind of optimistic because if it had hit 50,000, 5 or 6 days later, it was going to be at 60,000 already, which was his new target. You know, it was going to be 60,000. He's talking about through the summer. And then what I thought was even more surprising is that the group that was making the projection revised their projections upward. You know, it was clear that the 60,000 wasn't going to hold. It was clear that it was heading for 60,000. And I had said it was going to be 60,000 this month, which is April, the magic month when everything's going to disappear according to Trump. So they changed it, but I was surprised that they didn't. They apparently had made two updates. One had gone from 60,000 to 67,000, and then they upped it again from 67,000 to 74,000. And that was through August. And so after they did that, I looked at the numbers, and they really weren't changing. There was still 25,000 to 35,000 new cases every day. And there were still around 2,000 deaths every day. And it went a little below it a few days, especially on the weekends. And then it got up closer to 2,500 during the week. So it's kind of running close to 2,000 a day. And the deaths are a trailing indicator. So if there's 25 to 35,000 new cases, those new cases aren't going to die for 3 to 4 weeks. So that if you've got that many new cases coming in now or a week or two ago, then you've already filled up the pipeline. You've already got thousands of people in the hospital, of which a relatively high percentage of them are going to go in the ICU, and then a good percentage of those are going to go on a ventilator, and a very high percentage of those are going to end up dying. And so these are cases that are pretty well destined to increase the death levels significantly for the next 3-4 weeks. Right. And that's basically what happened this week. So this week, one of the milestones was there were a little over 58,000 died in the entire Vietnam War, and that was kind of passed, I guess, was it this morning or so? And then there was the 60,000 target, which was the revised target before they started revising it up, and it was Trump's target a week ago. 50 to 60. And so it hit 60,000 today. And it was pretty much right on schedule. I said a couple of weeks ago that it was going to hit 60,000 this month. And it wasn't anything really that unexpected as long as it continued at the same level that it was when I made that statement a couple of weeks ago. You know, the math was there. You were adding 10,000 every 5 or 6 days. And, at the time, there was about 40,000, so I just had to do that for a couple of weeks. And I set it in the middle of the month, and there was more than a couple of weeks till the end of the month. So it did hit that level. So now it's at 60,000. And it's hard to see how it's not going to top Trump's latest and greatest of 60 to 70. It's already past the 60. And it should get to 70,000 next week. And then the revised number from the predictor, it was only up to 74,000. So it should probably get up to 74,000 by the end of next week, or at the latest, the beginning of the following week, which is still going to be the beginning of May. You still have to go through June and July to get to the middle or beginning or middle of August to hit this 74,000. And so he's going to be forced to increase that again. And if he increases to 74, then we're starting to get back to the 100,000 that was originally at the lower end of how things would go if the social distancing was effective and kept in place, which gets us to the current situation with the social distancing. And right now, the CDC, you know, it kind of came out and they said, well, here's, or the you know, the COVID task group came out with this suggestions or what you need to do is they want to see a steady downward slope with the daily cases for 2 weeks. And
downward curve.
Sure.
Yes.
Right. And shortly after they made that statement, Governor Georgia came out and says, well, he's starting to lift the restrictions last Friday and chose all these, you know, beauty salons and nail salons and tattoo shops and all the bowling alleys, you know, various places where, you know, social distancing would not be doable. They could put on masks, but they certainly weren't going to be 6 feet apart. And he started listing those, and then the beginning of this week, you know, added movie theaters, and I don't know if they might even added dine-in restaurants, as long as it wasn't too full or something along those lines. And it was clear that they really weren't paying attention to this 10-day or 14-day downward slope in the number of new cases, and they even asked the governor, well, you know, what data are you using to decide? Because he kind of made this statement that, you know, he's going to do this, you know, it's going to be dictated by the science. You know, he's kind of calling out, you know, he's relying on science as he ignores the science, which are the daily reports. And a reporter asked him, well, what data are you using to say that you're, you know, following the science? And he says, oh, you follow on our website. We put it up, you know, we put up the daily numbers every day. And I said, well, yeah, that's what I looked at. The daily numbers every day. So the cases are going up. how does the increase in the cases, get translated into a steady downward slope for
it's magic
weeks.
Henry magic
and no he said that he talked to the medical director, and so then they asked the medical director what data are you using to decide that you can kind of lift the restrictions, and she says, well, you know, there were other considerations besides
unnamed.
The numbers. Right and so it was clear that Georgia was going to kind of ignore the rules. They were just going to say, well, we're going to go ahead and take these additional procedures. You know, we're going to be wearing masks. We're going to tell people to keep a separation, not have too many people in the store at any one time. But we're ready to get back to business and start lifting these restrictions. And, and then kind of a quick overview was that, all of the governors that announced they were lifting restrictions were in states that had not met the definition, like zero had met the definition. So they were going to ignore the definition and just say, well, they're going to be good going forward, and they're going to, you know, put these limitations in, but they're going to kind of be open for business, so to speak. And so the issue is that for these projections to be correct and or for the virus to kind of go down to levels that, as Trump said, they could just kind of stamp them out when there's little brush fires that kind of perk up, pop up here and there. They would just be small and they would stamp them out immediately. But that type of scenario is somewhat akin to, you know, what was done in China, except what China did is they did get the numbers down to close to zero before they started easing up on the restrictions. So they weren't talking about declining for 10 days and being at some level where there was plenty of virus circulating and saying, well, we did our part, it's time to get back to work. They're not even doing that. They're saying, well, we don't care what the level is, and we don't care that it's going up, and we don't care whether it's been steady, and we don't care if there really has been no decline, and we don't care if there's
that's exactly
25,000 cases every day. We're going to ignore the 25,000 cases a day, and we're going to ignore the 2,000 deaths a day, and we're just going to kind of ease up and figure that everything's fine, and we'll worry about it if it isn't. But they don't even say they're going to worry about it if it isn't. They just flip it around and say, you know, they got to get the economy going again, and they don't really talk about what they're going to do if it isn't. And there's very little
that's
doubt.
Not even on the table.
Right. There's very little doubt what's going to happen. I mean, Germany started to lift restrictions, and they had gotten things down to a much more controllable level, and they didn't get up to anywhere near where the United States got up to. And they noticed that the numbers started to go up almost immediately after they started easing up the restrictions.
If we see a seasonable diminution of the numbers of cases, when should that ideally be expected to show up? In the middle of May?
Well, Trump said it's April. His prediction will be null and void in 2 days.
Well, I'm just thinking they better hurry, because Jerry tells us everything's going to be back to normal by June.
Right. Well, here's what the problem is. You know, the one data set is by SARS, and SARS did seem to go down kind of in May, and by June it was pretty low. And the difference, though, was with SARS, it was a much, much smaller outbreak, that the international outbreaks outside of mainland China were largely due to one individual who went to the Metropole Hotel and infected a number of tourists. and they mostly went to individual cities. I mean, the Vietnam was in Hanoi, and Hanoi didn't really last that long. They kind of got Hanoi under control, I think within a month or so. So by, March, Hanoi was pretty much under control. And then, you know, Singapore was a little bit harder because there were like three sisters there. So they really had three different patients that went to Singapore. And then Toronto had problems. It kind of went in two ways, where they kind of got it under control and then it kind of got out of control again. And then Hong Kong was probably the worst, because it just had this one guy trying to control
there,
with
Henry?
His nebulizer.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think SARS was nearly as volatile as this particular virus. It didn't seem to be. It was bad, but this one seems to be astonishingly transmissible.
Right. And so the bottom line is that the virus did get under control, and it was under control pretty much in May and June, but it was much smaller, And the control was probably due not to the season and not to it getting warm or not even getting more sunlight, but more because of contact tracing. And so they basically, it was manageable enough to trace the contacts, get the contacts quarantined, and really stop the virus from spreading. And so in all of these countries, other than Hong Kong and maybe Taiwan, the most of the cases were limited to a single city, and it was really a couple of hospitals at that city. Uh-huh. So it wasn't that the whole city was infected, and it wasn't that it was spreading to other, you know, locations outside of the city.
Wouldn't that suggest a lower transmission rate or lower virulence in terms of transmission in SARS?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of healthcare workers got infected, which is one of the things that stood out. But they started with that single individual, and they know who the individuals were. And all three of those locations, mm-hmm. they know exactly who patient zero was. They know the name and the date and exactly when the outbreak began. And they knew who the contacts were, and they knew when there were breaches in that, and it kind of spread, you know, what was spreading it was funerals and hospitals. So the people that came in were on a gurney next to a case ended up getting infected, or relatives got infected when they went to the funeral. It was limited spread. You needed that type of activity. And if you got on top of the contacts, you know, tracing them and identifying them and getting them quarantined, then you could control the spread. And so that's largely what happened with SARS. You had these super spreaders. You had some of these events, which were, you know, big deal then. Big deal, they would be big deal relative to avian influenza or H5N1, which didn't really transmit that well. So those were, you could get some local human to human, but it was generally within families. And you had, you know, a handful of cases, or maybe you'd have 100 or so on a big outbreak. Whereas SARS, you got an order of magnitude higher, where you ended up with 770 or so dying and about 10 times that as far as the cases were concerned. But that was worldwide, and that was to these different cities that kind of had their own mini outbreaks, which involved, you know, several hundred people, or in some cases several hundred deaths. And, I don't know about several, but 100 deaths or so. And it was basically contained. And then it came back, but it really came back through intermediary posts, through civic cats again. And they started to spread the virus a second time in the fall. And uh-huh. then they did a lot of culling and got that under and contact tracing and got it under control again. And then at least officially, it just disappeared. There were no cases after that second outbreak, and that second outbreak was significantly smaller than the first outbreak. So it's not clear how much of that, you know, decline in cases was really a seasonal event, and how much of that decline in cases was just that's how long it took to basically do the case tracing and get them quarantined and break the transmission chain.
We're not even doing much contact tracing now. That's not happening. Trump today tried to put it on the states again. He's doing everything humanly possible to deflect any responsibility. You saw it, I guess. I don't look at these things. Let me just do this for our listeners real quick. On Monday, President Trump instructed states to, quote, maximize the use of all available testing platforms and venues. That was Monday, as they begin to plan their reemergence from lockdown. On Wednesday, today, just 2 days later, he downplayed that edict and mused, that people, that maybe blanket testing of people wasn't necessary at all as states moved to open. He said, you'll see some astonishing numbers. I don't know that all of that's even necessary. And you'll have some governors that love the tests. You have others that like doing it a different way, an old-fashioned way, with only some testing. This guy cannot stay on course for more than a day. He can't.
Right.
It's not possible.
Right. And but the whole concept is flawed, because the concept was that you were going to get the number of cases down to a manageable level. And therefore, once you got the cases down to a manageable level, then if you started easing and new cases started showing up, then you would be able, you would have the resources, and you'd have the tests, and you'd have the tracers, you'd have the manpower to go and to follow up on those new cases and get everybody quarantined and stop the spread, so that you might get an outbreak here and an outbreak there, but you would have the resources to get it under control. Right now, that's not happening. Right now, there are too many cases to do contact tracing, because it's community spread. The people that are infected now don't know how they got infected. Now, I mean, you have these outbreaks. I mean, the people at the processing plant know they got infected at the processing plant. And then their family members that got infected know they got infected by the worker from the processing plant who was a family member. He brought it home. And then if they went to some other, some other job, the spouse goes out to work, and then they develop it at the spouse's location, then that's where that came from. So you can do that type of tracing where it starts at a given location and it spreads out. But most of the cases are just, I don't know how I got infected, over, you know, these larger cities where they're literally having 1,000 cases a day. Right. Those 1,000 cases have no idea how they got infected. It was a community infection. I assume I got infected, you know, in New York, or I got infected in Philadelphia, or I got infected in Boston. But I don't know who infected me in those cities. And there's literally thousands of cases that are active in those cities. And so they have no, or in the case of New York, there were millions of cases, you know, at one point. So the idea is that the number is going to get low enough so that you can get back to contact tracing and you can put out new outbreaks. Right now,
it's
already
at
too high. Right now, it's at too high a level. So that as you start easing things up, you're going to continue at the community level. You're going to have people, you're going to, if you do testing, you're going to see that the numbers are going up, but you're not going to know how they're going up unless it's at, you know, one of these facilities. And I think part of the reason Trump doesn't want to get more kit and allow for widespread testing is because a lot of these locations, like long-term care facilities or prisons or these meat or poultry or pork processing plants, they already know that there are a lot more positives at those locations than have been identified because they haven't been tested. And in some cases, like the processing plants, even when they get the kit and they can do the testing, they end up electing not to do the testing because they know there's going to be way too many positives. And if they have half of the plant is positive, then they're all going to say, well, you know, they shouldn't go to work. And then all of a sudden they can't really operate the plant because their workforce has been cut in half because half of them are infected, and the other half that test negative aren't necessarily negative anyway. You know, they may just be recently infected and they don't have enough virus to come out and be a positive. So the bottom line is that the testing is limited. The numbers aren't low enough to really do contact tracing. And those that think they can say, well, you literally need millions of tests, because not only do you want to do contact tracing, before workers go back to their place of their occupation, you know, if they're going to be working on site, they want to know that their coworkers aren't infected. So they want their coworkers tested before they go back. And that's why they need all of the test kits. And there's a shortage of the test kits. So you're not able to insure the workers.
Right.
And that's what's, and that's why the supplies, the food supply is endangered, is because these plants, you know, whether they've been tested or not, they've tested some of the symptomatic cases and they have enough positives there. And they even have deaths at these plants. So they know how
almost
many people have been infected.
Yeah.
How many? Yeah, I think it's even over that, because they're all over the place. And it's a limited number of companies. I think there's something like less than 10, you know, 5 to 8 or so companies that control something like 80% of beef
right.
and poultry and pork in the United States. And you keep seeing the same companies showing up over and over again. You got Tyson's, you got this JBS meat or whatever their name
JBS,
is.
JBS, they're Brazilian, wholly owned Brazilian, huge corporation.
And so they have kind of the same conditions at all of their plants. And so they're way too close to each other. The density's too high. The virus gets in there and it just spreads, and they don't really do adequate testing. And you can spread the virus when you're asymptomatic. So, you know, if you're not going to test everybody, you're going to miss people that are still transmitting the virus. And if you wait for them to be symptomatic, you're going to have the spread. I mean, I just heard an update for the one in Waterloo, Iowa. And that's a Tyson plant there. And they had 300 positives last week. And they just did more extensive testing. They got 2,600 employees. And they've got over, I think, 1,300 positives now. 44% of those tested came back positive. So now they've got, you know, this plant that they can't really keep operating because they don't have enough people. And then they're infecting their family members that are infecting others. So it sounds like they've got an outbreak at a long-term care facility because a spouse of somebody that was at the meat processing plant worked at long-term care. And then they apparently have it in their prisons because somebody that was in the prison system was a spouse of somebody who worked in the processing plant. And so the numbers in Waterloo, Iowa now are just starting to explode, not only at the plant, but at other locations where have a high level of people that are at risk.
Well, it's a high density. Residential neighborhoods, apartment buildings, where these people go home from work.
Right.
Here's another Shakespearean angle to Trump's disintegration. He does remind me of Othello to a large degree, the way he's slowly going mad. CNN, as he huddled with advisors on Friday evening last, President Donald Trump was still fuming over his sliding poll numbers and the onslaught of criticism he was facing for suggesting a day earlier that ingesting disinfectant might prove effective against coronavirus. Well, within moments, the president was shouting, not at the aides in the room last Friday, but into the telephone at his campaign manager, Brad Parscale. Shifting the blame away from himself, Trump berated Parscale and threatened to sue him at one point for a recent spate of damaging poll numbers. it's unbelievable.
He's not reality based. He just basically takes the numbers and tries to twist the numbers. And he could kind of do this with poll numbers by just picking and choosing whatever poll he wants to talk about and ignoring the other ones or having the private polls and saying they look good because they're private and they can't really be checked on. But the problem is, he tries to to control the virus by lying, and it doesn't work. The virus doesn't care what he says. they don't care what kind of home remedies he's going to try to get people to take that's going to kill them. The virus is going to go ahead. It doesn't care if you're testing. It doesn't need to be, validated by a test to infect the next person. And these conditions exist so they can just hop from person to person. And it just keeps on spreading. And that's why.
Henry, 700 Iranians have died from drinking methanol, thinking that that would help internally destroy the virus and protect them? 700 Iranians have died.
They read these things on the internet. They believe them, and they start, these rumors just start going. You do X, Y, and Z, and they just run with it. I mean, there were all these calls that went into poison centers asking about, Lysol or whatever.
But Trump denied that, I wonder if it was really true. Trump said it wasn't. He told me it wasn't true.
Right.
But the poison control center say, yes.
Or he hadn't heard about that. Right, right. Or why would they do that?
That's what he said. He did say that.
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
So.
And then I don't know anything about it.
It's ridiculous.
Is the guy the worst liar ever? He's not even a good liar. Some liars are pretty good at it. Trump is just childlike in his idiocy. He is not an effective liar.
Right. And you can pretty well tell what he's lying, when he's lying. And then whenever he's, trying to blame somebody for something, that's because he's guilty. So, anything he does, he immediately transfers it to somebody else. I mean, that's why this is all China's fault. And there's so many cases in the U.S. because they're colluding with WHO to hide X, Y, and Z. Like China wanted. He said they could have stopped it. Now, why wouldn't China stop it if they could have stopped it? I mean, they didn't need to have the whole city of Wuhan shut down, and they're still trying to recover from this, and they're still concerned about new cases popping up, and now they're surrounded by countries that are positive, including Europe and the U.S. I mean, they're not surrounded by the U.S., but there's potential of trade and flights and personnel going back and forth, and so. The idea, I mean, that's his point of view. He thinks that China didn't stop it because they wanted to infect the United States or something. Something just totally crazy. It was in China. If they wanted to infect the United States, they would have just brought it to the United States. They didn't have to start it in Wuhan and shut down their city to do whatever. They definitely wanted to get it under control. The only reason they were hiding things is they didn't want people to know how bad it was, and they wanted to kind of get it under control and said it wasn't really a problem. And when it was clear that it was a problem, and WHO called it fake, I mean, there was nothing to really deny anyway. So anyway, Tamara, I want to just touch base on this remdesivir. It sounds like they got clinical trial data that's strong enough that it's showing an effect. The effect isn't that big, but it is kind of a start. So that
all right,
was kind
we'll
of
touch on that tomorrow
today.
As well. All right. Thank you, Henry. Thanks again.
Okay. Take care. Talk to you, Mark.
All righty. Good night. Okay, there you go. And we have a whole lot of news up there for you to go through. Share it, spread it around. But bottom line is, President Kushner is telling us all that things will be back to normal by June. There you go. Trump also now is downplaying, as I mentioned earlier, the need for testing. That's what they're calling a whiplash contradiction. How do you tell Trump's lying? He's talking. Back in a minute. Well, 21 hours, but it seems like a minute. Thanks for being here. Take care. Talk to you tomorrow.